This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday. That means time for the Week in Review. And the news that Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has been drawn into a federal investigation of allegations of strong-arm tactics used by union leaders against developers and other businesses in the region. Now, here's how former State Inspector General Greg Sullivan explains the investigation.
The issue at hand is whether the permitting agencies in the city of Boston and other cities have been improperly used to put pressure on private citizens and developers to hire union labor. And if that is happening, it would represent a very serious thing and one that should be completely eradicated.
Now, the events in question date back to when Walsh worked as a union leader, but before he became mayor, Walsh was on Herald Radio this week on Wednesday, where he denied any wrongdoing.
I never bullied anybody, any developer. I mean, that's just not my style. And anyone that knows me knows it's not my style. I just know that when I built these relationships, it was important for me to reach out and try and get more work for the men and women of the trades and whatever tools were at my disposal. What I mean by that, there was opportunities for market recovery money and some other things. And it's about building a dialogue and building a conversation.
Well, joining us now in the studio to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and editor of Architecture Boston magazine. She also writes for WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Renee, it's great to see you again.
Happy to be here.
Also with us is Jabari Asim. He's professor of creative writing at Emerson College and executive editor of The Crisis, the journal for the National NAACP. Jabari, it's great to see you as well.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, let me just get a quick response or quick thoughts from both of you on your initial reactions to when you heard through the Boston Globe's reporting that the mayor had been drawn in to this federal investigation.
Well, I mean, this may be obvious to say, but you have to separate the politics of the situation from the law. Okay, no public official likes to be found on a wiretap. That's not a good thing. But the question of whether any laws have been broken, that is a separate issue and a complicated one. Mm-hmm. There are laws, you know, federal laws, the Hobbs Act, so-called, which governs whether union activities cross a line into extortion or, other wrongful behaviors. But there's a lot of conflicting court opinions on this, and it's really hard to say how the law will turn out. The politics are another matter.
Exactly. Jabari, your thoughts?
Well, there's also the laws involving the leaking of information.
Yeah.
And if federal agents, in fact, leaked information, then they've broken the law. So it's I think part of it is just a sense of frustration in terms of where the information is. The Walsh administration has declined to share a lot of documents so far. We don't know where the leaks are coming from on the other side. So a lot of it is dependent upon what we find out.
Right. And so that's a really great point, Jabari, because just to remind folks, a lot of this came out because of a leak of that 2012 wiretap that you were talking about, Renee. And so there is a question about whether or not U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz should be investigating the leak as well. And in fact, Mayor Walsh himself brought that up when he was speaking to Boston Herald Radio this week. And he also called into questions the motivations that he sees at play possibly behind the leak.
The facts of that were in the paper, were in the Globe. They're unclear. So that which would make me believe it's unclear whether or not there is a leak. I don't know if there is a leak. I don't know what the case is going on. I mean, who knows? I mean, some of the stuff that people are talking about could be made up. Meaning people could have a vendetta or upset with me because maybe they're not doing business in the city of Boston and they feel that they had a better access under the past administration. That could be the case.
Well, Renee, I mean, there's a lot of coulds, maybes, who knows. I mean, the truth is we don't know. But I wonder what you make of what impact this might have on Walsh himself. There's no one's accused him directly of anything, but he is, you know, he's had to spend the week responding to all of this.
Yes, of course. And, you know, he has very long and proud relationships with the unions. You know, this is part of how he became mayor, with the support of working men in the city and women in the city. But I'm sure this is frustrating for him because the standards here, as with, you know, campaign contributions and patronage and conflicts of interest and other aspects of what's acceptable in public life, these standards are shifting. And I think that this is a situation where he may feel that what was once perfectly acceptable from a union official to advocate on behalf of his members or advocate on behalf of developers hiring union workers is now suddenly somebody has changed the rules of the game or that the interpretations are different. And, you know, it makes for a very murky kind of situation.
Right. I mean, murky is a perfect word to put for it because it does seem like it's not very clear about when groups are crossing the line between, you know, influence, you know, above board business, coercion, because there's so much overlap between unions and politicians and businesses and developers. It is a murky relationship almost by definition, Jabari.
Sure. And what is the difference now between, say, strong advocacy and, quote, strong arm tactics? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even know if it's illegal for my advocate to say, if you don't look into hiring union workers, then your next development is going to be it's going to be in trouble. I mean, it's something that you're going to have to address. I mean, I'm not sure. Is that threatening, or is that from the point of view of the worker? Is that my advocate speaking out for me and trying to make sure that I find gainful employment?
Right.
And exactly. And, you know, in 1973, the Supreme Court, of course, I looked this up. in 1973, the Supreme Court threw out some convictions, federal convictions against union officials who had acted in some pretty, iffy ways, you know, with the ruling the Supreme Court did that even violence is permissible if it's in the furtherance of the union's protected rights to organize and to strike. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was some many years ago, and there have been efforts in Congress to clarify that line, that bright line we're talking about. But so far, that Supreme Court decision stands.
Okay. Well, there is certainly going to be more discussion about this in the coming weeks and months, depending on further information, if any, is forthcoming on this story. So let's just switch gears here a little and talk about another major story of the week, and that is Deflategate. Because on Monday, a federal appeals court reinstated Patriot quarterback Tom Brady's suspension. The way I was reading that, it almost sounded like they reinstated him, but no, they reinstated his suspension for his alleged role in Deflategate. We should note that the appeals court did not rule one way or another about Brady's involvement in it, just on his suspension. But here's how NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell explained the ruling on CBS just yesterday.
Well, this wasn't about the actual violation. This was about the rights that we had negotiated in our collective bargaining agreement, that we had in our collective bargaining agreement, and that we wanted to make sure that we retained.
Okay, so that's NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell's view. I should note that if Tom Brady wants to appeal this, I think his next stop is the United States Supreme Court. But Jabari, your first thoughts on this?
Well, I think first he has to successfully appeal to a panel of all the judges in the circuit.
In the appellate circuit, okay.
Right. Well, part of the discussion, and I think this has been pointed out by a number of people, is that it seems the dispute has been steered away from the deflate part of Deflategate. And I think it was Sally Jenkins who pointed out in the Washington Post that, you know, no one has yet to make a case that human agency was behind the deflating of the footballs. And so that even is not a part of the discussion right now, at least the most recent decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, let me just stipulate that I am hardly an expert in this story. But, you know, I think it's important that this ruling did not address the facts of the case and only upheld Commissioner Goodell's right to make this decision to suspend for four games. You know, if I were Brady and if he were me, and clearly he's not because you could just look at his salary, but, you know, if it were me, I would just try to put this behind me and my team and, you know, accept the, you know, the suspension and say that it had no bearing on whether or not I'm guilty of these charges. But, you know, if the players don't like this situation, they can negotiate another contract with the NFL in the future. All this case did was uphold Goodell's right to issue the suspension.
So do you think that this latest turn in the Deflategate story would have any impact beyond football at all? Because we are talking, as Goodell himself mentioned, about collective bargaining agreements and, you know, the NFL's, the league's ability itself to impose sanctions based on the terms of those agreements. I mean, fundamental union and employer contract negotiations. I mean, they're all individual based on the union and the employer that you're talking about. But I can't help but wonder if, you know, there could be any sort of a ripple effect here.
Well, I think unions are certainly going to have to regard the fine tuning, the finer points of their collective bargaining agreements, really with rigorous scrutiny, because it seems that this one is vaguely worded enough that certain questions aren't answered. For example, why would this form of tampering merit a suspension as opposed to a fine? If you use an illegal adhesive in a football game that makes the football adhere to your hands, you're going to be fined. If you violate the rules regarding your uniform, you're going to be fined. You're not going to be suspended for 4 games. So what in the collective bargaining agreement is so flexible that it allows this kind of range of punishment?
Well, before we leave Deflategate entirely, let's hear the voice of a True Blue Pats fan and his reaction. Here's a man who called himself Sully on Sports Hub Radio this week.
This is wicked awful, all right? Let me tell you something. Tom Brady is a god. He is a god. And there is no reason in the world why Roger Goodell could be this judge, jury, and executioner guy. He should be kissing Tom Brady's feet. Without him, he wouldn't even have a job. This is absolutely insane. This is our quarterback here. This is our football season here. This is ridiculous.
Passions run high with football and New England sports. I mean, there's no denying that. Okay, so let's move on to another story of this week that actually just had its latest turn just yesterday afternoon, and that is the tobacco bill that's made its way through the State House in that a proposal that would ban the sale of tobacco products to anyone in Massachusetts under the age of 21. And as we mentioned, the State Senate yesterday passed the bill in a virtual unanimous vote. There were a couple nays. And now it heads to the House and eventually Governor Baker's desk. So, Renee, what do you think about lifting the tobacco sale age to 21?
Yeah, well, you know, it's always complicated when we say as a society that you can vote and you can marry and you can, you know, serve in the military at age 18, but you can't purchase a legal product, you know, until you're 21. So, I mean, I think there are reasons to point out the inequities there, if you want to call it that. That said, I think that as a society, we have so much to benefit from the having healthy citizenry, both in terms of, you know, the healthcare costs and productivity and every other kind of thing, that I think in this case, you have to say that the public good sort of trumps the tobacco company profits, maybe, or the personal rights of people to, you know, give themselves cancer.
Well, the bill did face some opposition from the Massachusetts Retailers Association. We've got some tape here from Ryan Kearney, who's general counsel for them. And he said they opposed the ban because they believe it would hurt local businesses. And he also says he doesn't believe it would do much to curb youth smoking.
You get an 18, 19, 20-year-old that wants to smoke, we think that they're going to go across the border to New Hampshire to buy these things. And, you know, there are heavy restrictions on Internet sales, but there is still avenues for kids to get tobacco products over the Internet.
Jabari, your thoughts?
That's my thought exactly. That was my first thing I thought. If you want to smoke and you're under 18, you're going to find a way to smoke. So I'm doubtful of the efficacy of that. Like Renee, I kind of appreciate this nod toward the public good that, you know, overall this is something that benefits society. And Renee mentioned an individual's right to give him or herself cancer. But, you know, there's secondhand smoke, there's thirdhand smoke, there's those other issues. So you can argue that the benefits do kind of radiate outward from the individual to the community.
Yeah, it's interesting because we have so many of these examples of how far should we as a society and the state legislate our way towards greater health versus, you know, other means of doing so.
Yeah, I'm not moved at all by the argument that people are going to go across the border to New Hampshire and buy cigarettes. Of course they will. But we in Massachusetts get to make a choice about the kind of state that we want to be. And we want to be a state that encourages healthful behaviors. I can get behind that.
Mm-hmm. By the way, before we get to our hubbubs, there was something that I should have mentioned a little bit earlier regarding the Marty Walsh conversation, because you both very kindly disclosed to us that Renee, the Boston Society of Architects, is partnering with the Walsh administration on ideas for the Northern Avenue Bridge. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't produce any conflicts, but we just wanted to disclose that. And Jabari, you also wanted us to disclose that you're the member of a union, the American Association of University Professors.
Yes.
As well. So full disclosure there. I'm sorry that I didn't do that during the actual conversation about Mayor Walsh. But we've got just enough time now for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe didn't make it above the fold in this busy week, but dessert or not anyway. Jabari, why don't I get you yours first?
Well, Amazon initially had declined to provide same-day delivery services to certain parts of Boston, the Roxbury community. And now, after pressure from the mayor and different citizen advocacy groups, they have backed away from that and are now going to provide same-day delivery services to Roxbury, which to me, it's a wonderful development. And I have to say, a little bit surprising. When I first learned about it, I thought that Amazon would not be persuaded to knuckle under and do this. So I think it's a wonderful thing.
A turn for the better. Next week, we're on the show going to try to examine the emerging role that data is playing when it comes to racial and economic inequity, sure, and whether our data-driven society could actually possibly make that worse. So we're going to take a deeper look at that next week. But it's a great story to be reminded of this week. Renee, your hubbub?
Well, you've already previewed it, but it has to do with one of my favorite structures in Boston and also one of the most endangered, the Northern Avenue Bridge, which is this historic pedestrian crossing over the Four Point Channel that has been in disrepair for many years and is a lot of people are talking about just tearing it down. But the Walsh administration has joined with the Boston Society of Architects, where I work, to issue a call for proposals and ideas to try to preserve the bridge. You don't have to be an architect or an engineer to do it. You can be, an average citizen. In fact, I understand that a high school student has, put in his ideas. The solution is to try to find, a design that improves the mobility of that area, that honors the legacy of the bridge, and that also creates a distinctive gateway to the innovation district there. I almost called it the inundation district, which it's also known to be.
Give sea level rise its inevitable time, and it might happen.
The deadline for this contest is actually today, but I'm just very hopeful that it will generate enough ideas to try to figure out a way to save this remnant of Boston's industrial past.
We definitely will want to check in with you as the contest proceeds, because it's a really exciting possibility and potential for the city.
Stay tuned.
Okay, so here's my hubbub, because it happened just this afternoon at the White House during a White House press briefing. Here it is.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. I was going to tell you all to be seated, but I see you are already seated, so we can begin. Josh is out today. He has, I believe it's a root canal. Yeah, he has a root canal, but let's be honest, I'm better at this than he is anyway, right, just between us.
Okay, so hardcore West Wing fans are going to recognize C.J. Craig, a.k.a. actress Allison Janney, who played White House press secretary on the West Wing. This was actually in a real White House press briefing. Wow. She showed up today and played the role of C.J. Craig, pretending that the current real White House press secretary, Josh Earnest, wasn't there. He did show up magically a little bit later. So a little sort of fiction meets reality there. But it turns out that Janney was in Washington to talk about the opioid addiction crisis, an issue that she is personally very passionate about. So just when I was going to get all harsh and cynical and critical about President Obama's relationship to Hollywood, it turns out there's a real reason why C.J. Craig or Allison Janney was at the White House today. So that's my hubbub. Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and editor of Architecture Boston and writer for WBR's Cognoscenti page. Always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Jabari Yassin, professor of creative writing at Emerson and executive editor of The Crisis, the journal for the National NAACP. Always great to have you as well.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.